Guardian Unlimited.
Hi ho, campers. I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. If you're listening to us for the first time, ready yourself for some thrills, spills, and the occasional chills. And that's just our opening music. Coming up on this week's show, is that a Large Hadron Collider in your pocket, or are you just pleased to see me? We go behind the scenes at CERN with particle physicist Dr. Brian Cox and Captain Jack from Torchwood and Doctor Who. Plus, we'll be discussing the controversial attempts to try and get homeopathic treatment taken off the NHS. And we look ahead, back and sideways, to this year's Hay Festival. There's a lot of sciencey types there, you know? You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky, punk? This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. It's a very limited cast joining me in the pod this week. First up, science correspondent James Randerson.
Hello, I feel lucky.
You look it as well. Bobby J is back.
I was born lucky.
And, well, that's it, really. Well, apart from Science Weekly producer Ben Green. Ben, you're relatively new to this science thing, but I understand Saturday nights for you just aren't complete without a fix of this. I think it's become traditional for me to criticise your music at this stage. You can't believe that's the worst version of the Doctor Who theme ever recorded. Where'd you find this stuff? Still, Doctor Who's one thing, but Captain Jack was the real star of that show, so much that he got his own TV show, Torchwood. John Barrowman plays Captain, and our friend Dr. Brian Cox invited him along to see how the people at CERN in Geneva were getting on in developing the 27-kilometre Large Hadron Collider. Now, it really is impossible to overstate the significance of this particle accelerator, probably the biggest scientific experiment of all time. When it's switched on later on this year, it'll recreate the conditions of the universe less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, and that, in turn, will create a whole new field of research for scientists to pore over. Anyway, enough from me. Here's Dr. Brian Cox.
We're going through one of the controlled access points, which are James Bond. Have you ever seen one of those Bond movies where there's just a little shed in a field with a lift, and then it goes down into this underground installation? That's what these experiments are like. There's almost nothing on the surface at all.
It looks like a machine that you'd run your Oyster card through, but then there's these huge big orange doors to get into.
You see, if they had those on the underground, then nobody would cheat, would they? You can't jump that barrier. So we're in the final focus region. So this is where the two proton beams, one going 27 kilometres around one way and one 27 kilometres around the other way, actually meet in the centre of Atlas, and you get those little mini big bangs. And where I'm standing now, in about 6 months' time, would be... painful. If you want a small hole drilled through you by an aircraft carrier, then this is the place to be.
Brian, why is the whole tunnel itself have to be 27 kilometres? Why such the size?
The size sets the energy. So the bigger the machine is, the faster you can get these things going, so the further back in time you can go. And 27 kilometres, I suppose, in a sense, is the biggest you can afford. The reason is, actually, that when you get a proton and you send it around a corner, then it radiates X-rays. It's how you make X-rays, actually. In a hospital, you get something like a proton or electron and shake it around. So that loses energy. So you want the corners to be as shallow as you possibly can so they don't lose as much energy.
Right.
So you can get it going. And we're already using 120, 130 megawatts to keep them going around this. So if it was smaller, you'd have to put a lot more energy in.
But that's where they're going to come together.
Well, here. I mean, so standing here now, the one lot would be going that way, and one lot would be going the other way. And that tiny, you can see it, it's absolutely tiny.
Yeah, the little hole.
Yeah, it goes through there. Each one is going at 99.999999% the speed of light. At which speed? It's 7,000 times heavier than it would be when it stood still. Such is the weirdness of relativity.
So the faster it's moving, the heavier it gets. And that's because of...
relativity, it's Einstein.
Right.
It's very strange. And the other amazing thing is that time... for the protons, passes 7,000 times more slowly than it does for us. So if you were a proton going around here, 1 second for us would feel like 1/7,000th of a second for a proton. Or in other words, 1 second for the proton would feel like 7,000 seconds for us, which is an amazing consequence of relativity.
Well, it's almost... difficult to get your head around.
Time travel.
Yeah.
It really is time travel.
That's what you're doing then.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Well, the protons, they go around in they go around the machine in 20 centimeter long bunches, actually. So they travel in little packets, and we collide those together 40 million times a second. So once every 25 nanoseconds, those 20 centimeter bunches pass through each other. And even then, you've got to understand the machine to make the protons collide. I mean, pretty much these bunches of protons will just go straight through each other. And when we first turn the machine on, we'll be lucky to get one proton hitting one other proton. But when we get to understand it a bit better, we can get up to 30 or 35 proton collisions per bunch crossing, which is immensely difficult, actually. Could you imagine banging 35 of them together? You get a lot of crap flying out, and you've got to try and burrow in there to find the one interesting thing that happened. We're at Atlas. This is my experiment, me and about 2,500 others, and it's 7,000 tons of digital camera. I mean, one way of thinking about it, actually, John, is that what you'd really want is a time machine. You really want to go back to the start of the Big Bang and just take as many pictures as you can. But we can't do that, or we don't know how to do that at the moment. So this is the next best thing. You recreate it inside this 7,000-ton digital camera and take a picture 40 million times a second.
So you will actually get a photographic image of what happens.
Yeah, it's exactly that. The inner detector is called a silicon detector, and it's basically CCDs. It's the same thing that's in a digital camera, pretty much. And it just takes pictures 40 million times a second of these little big bangs that we recreate.
All right, well, let's go in and see it.
Oh my.
And this is by far the biggest particle physics detector ever built. 7,000 tons of detector. And all those huge things you can see there are magnets. It's a monster, isn't it?
It's just, you know what it looks, from this end, it looks like some kind of jet engine.
Yeah.
The back end of like a retro jet engine with the, and those are the exhaust pipes around it, doesn't it, Scott?
And they're still wiring that up. I mean, that's what those guys are doing. They're just plugging the wires in.
But see, what's amazing to me is how do they know what to, I know. That's just what, how do they know what to plug in?
Because you look at it. I mean, it's just miles of spaghetti everywhere.
That's a cool crane. Sorry, this is totally, like, not about...
Easily distracted.
Yeah, totally.
And so the secrets of the universe will be... Yeah,
but
shut
cool
up.
Crane.
It's a cool crane.
That was Dr. Brian Cox and Captain Jack, also known as the actor John Barrowman. If you want to hear the whole of that feature, you can listen to it as this week's Science Extra. It's part of a series of podcasts featuring artists, architects and literary types giving their opinion on the work that's going on at CERN. We'll be bringing you more from these series over the coming months and more details on the blog. I'm Alok Jha. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we ask, we're not going to ask that. Still to come, we ask, does Wi-Fi really fry your children's brain? Plus, doctors renew their drive to ban homeopathy on the NHS. What do you think about the science of alternative therapy? That's all coming up, of course. But first, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
Leading scientists have called an investigation into the possible dangers of Wi-Fi technology by the BBC programme Panorama grossly unscientific and a scare story. The programme claimed that the radiation given off by Wi-Fi laptops were 3 times higher than the signal strength of a typical phone mast. But critics said the programme didn't take into account basic scientific concepts and presented a bogus comparison.
Britain's wildlife will be damaged by climate change unless we take action now to preserve habitat and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A new government study said that birds such as the song thrush and skylark could disappear from much of the UK as temperatures rise in the coming decades, while others such as the capercaillie could become locally extinct.
A magnetic field can stimulate the brain and promote the growth of new nerve cells. The transcranial magnetic stimulation technique raises the possibility of treating conditions linked to neuron death, such as Alzheimer's disease, and even one day perhaps enhancing humans' memory capacity. It's already used experimentally to treat disorders such as depression, Parkinson's, and schizophrenia.
And finally, scientists have solved the mystery of how a baby shark appeared in a tank of females without the help of a male. It was a virgin birth. The bonnethead shark was born through parthenogenesis, a process where an egg develops into an embryo without being fertilised by sperm. The birth in 2001 astonished scientists because sharks were not thought to be able to do this.
And that was your News Jam. Thank you to Ben and Bobby there. Word perfect enunciation, innit? Let's examine a couple of those stories a little bit closer. James, you covered the Wi-Fi story, the BBC Panorama programme that went out last week, but you found a slightly different angle to everyone else.
Yes, the press release that went out on the Sunday, I mean, when I was reading it, I just thought, you know, this doesn't make sense to me. They were saying, in the press release, they were saying that we've done an experiment in our programme that's going to go out tomorrow night, and it shows that the radiation coming out of a Wi-Fi laptop is 3 times the strength of a mobile phone mast. That just seemed to me that's absurd, because a mobile phone mast obviously has to transmit over hundreds of metres, maybe more, to reach mobile phones that are that far away, whereas Wi-Fi has only got to go over a few tens of meters, you know, and obviously the amount of power that those things can generate is much higher. So
was the program actually inaccurate then?
When I actually watched the program, it was quite clear what they'd done, and there you can sort of argue about the justification for what they'd done. Essentially, they were saying, okay, we took our measurement 100 metres away from the mobile phone mast and a metre away from the laptop, so that's why the laptop measurement
like
was higher.
Like.
No, they weren't, but they would sort of say, well, you know, a child is never going to be a metre away from a mobile phone mast. Well, you know, okay, but, you know, the comparison that was presented for the media and that lots of our colleagues kind of served up without any kind of critical comment was Wi-Fi 3 times more dangerous than mobile phone masts.
Obviously, a lot of research still to be done there. Bobby, you're a man who obviously has a lot of Wi-Fi radiation fired at him all the time.
I didn't see the programme because I wasn't in the country at the time, but I think there's a lot to be said about how the scare aspect of this was drummed up, how they compared different spectrums, different technologies. I mean, Wi-Fi operates on the same spectrum, more or less, as a microwave oven, which you'll find out if you ever try and use your laptop next to one. It kind of goes a bit pants. But, you know, there didn't seem to be much comparison about the different technologies and the different impacts and the studies that were done in lots of different areas. So I wonder, you know, really, can they justify their stance behind this?
One more thing I wanted to add, which is they had Sir William Stewart on the show, who is the head of the Health Protection Agency, and he did a very influential report on the safety of mobile phones in 2000. And they made a big thing of the fact that he was calling for a kind of a review into the technology to find out, you know, what do we know, what are the dangers, trying to work out if there really is a problem, which is, you know, is a fair enough stance for anyone to take, really. Apparently, there was a part in his interview, my sources tell me, that was cut out, where he said that in the meantime, while we're doing this, it's fine for schools to carry on using it, which rather sort of takes the wind out of their argument that, you know, we should have some kind of moratorium.
You're talking about selective editing there. You lay the bare bones of any journalism, and it's
always, we never always, do that.
It's always that. It's always a bit unpleasant. Bobby, we'll move on. This virgin birth of the shark, which I know that you're an expert on now. It took 6 years to confirm the study. What was going on?
It's a long time, but apparently DNA techniques have advanced over the years that allowed them to double check that they were getting this right. And of course, because parthenogenesis hasn't been seen in sharks before, they wanted to make sure they got this right. They did. Well, I mean, would you? You know, there are lots of theories about maybe they were two females that had been caught in the wild, and maybe one of them was still carrying some male sperm from the wild, and lots of different things. But eventually, they discovered that, you know, yeah, virgin birth.
Well, I'm shocked.
Although I do want to point out, though, that anyone waiting for the second coming of the shark Christ isn't going to get what they want, because unfortunately the little blighter died the same day that he was born.
Sad, wasn't it?
He was killed by a stingray.
Oh my god! Stingrays, evil creatures, aren't they? Really quickly, then, James, at the end, that magnetic stimulation theory—the fact that it could potentially increase your memory and so on—is it true?
Well,
it's published and everything, but come on.
It's only been done in mice. All they've shown is that you get an increase in the number of nerve cells, or the stem cells that lead to nerve cells. They haven't actually shown any kind of increase in the mice's ability yet. You know, they haven't looked at their memory or anything like that. So that's all to come. So, you know, it's very, very early days.
All right. Well, I consider myself fully enlightened on all those stories. If you out there in Podland want to add any of your thoughts to any of these topics, send us an email or post a comment on the blog. More details coming up at the end of the show. Now, a group of eminent doctors and scientists have stepped up their campaign to stop homeopathic treatment being funded on the National Health Service. The letter, which was sent to all NHS primary healthcare trusts, argues that any evidence of the beneficial effects of alternative therapy is equivocal at best. James, you've been following this story for a while. What's the latest development?
Well, this is a year on from a similar letter that was sent last year by 13 eminent scientists, including one Nobel Prize winner, six fellows of the Royal Society. This year, it was headed up by Professor Gustav Born, who's an emeritus professor of pharmacology at King's College, and one of our favourites on the pod, Professor Raymond Tallis. They were writing to all the primary healthcare trusts, so the people, for those not in the UK, the organisations that kind of, the regional organisations of the NHS that hold the purse strings. And they were saying, look, you should stop spending money on homeopathy because all the evidence says that it doesn't work any better than a placebo. So I talked to David Colquhoun, Professor of Pharmacology at UCL, about the letter. He's one of the signatories. This is what he said.
It varies. I mean, quite a lot has been spent in London. I just learned, for example, that Camden is spending £700,000 a year referring people to the Royal London Homeopathic, and the refurbishment of that building cost £20 million. Makes you gasp a bit, that, doesn't it?
I mean, your objection is that homeopathy is not proven to work. What, how would you characterise the state of the evidence?
Remember, they had 200 years to get the evidence, and it is lousy. You don't have to take my word for that. Even Peter Fisher, who's the Queen's homeopathic physician and the clinical director at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital, agreed with me on television that there wasn't enough science there, at least to run a BSc degree. It has been analysed endlessly, and there is next to no convincing evidence. All the good trials come out negative, including some, I should say, done by homeopaths.
And so any benefit that is there is essentially a kind of placebo effect?
I think that's pretty universally agreed among everyone except a few homeopaths, yes.
There's been some outcry from patients about threats of closures of the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital, things like that. You know, it seems to be quite popular with patients. Why do you think that is?
They are popular, and it's not always been the way. In the 60s, it was almost dead, actually. But in around 1980, there was a sudden increase in delusional thinking, which perhaps you might call it New Age thinking, perhaps, in which what was true and what was false suddenly seemed to cease to matter. And there's all sorts of manifestations of that apart from complementary medicine. You could cite also the rise in various extreme and fundamentalist forms of religion, both Islam and sort of Christian Taliban in the southern United States. You could talk about the delusion that there are WMD in Iraq. It became fashionable not to think about evidence, but just to believe whatever was convenient to you and pretend that it was true. Now, quite why that is, I don't know, but I think the trend is beginning to come to an end, and about time too.
And just finally, you mentioned that this was a year anniversary after the last letter that went out to PCT saying there's no evidence for homeopathy. This is from a group of 13 eminent scientists, including you. What effect did that letter have?
It actually had a bigger effect than I dared to imagine it would do at the time. A lot of trusts now have decided that this is not a sensible way to spend money. They'd rather spend money on drugs which have been tested properly and which have some beneficial effect. And that seems very sensible to me. The Tunbridge Wells Homeopathic Hospital and the Royal London Homeopathic are both at risk. They may close, and that, I think, will be all to the better because the money can be spent on better treatments, including supportive and palliative treatments, but just honest ones, not dishonest ones like homeopathy.
That was David Colquhoun, who's a pharmacologist at University College London. James, there's been quite a lot of activity on Comment is Free on this subject, isn't it? There's been hundreds of comments.
That's right. Well, they pasted up the letter and let people comment on that, and then they had a response comment, effectively, from Peter Fisher, who's clinical director at the London Homeopathic Hospital. He claimed, you know, actually, there's plenty of evidence that homeopathy works, and he said, economic studies consistently show that integrating homeopathy in medical practice results in better outcomes for the same cost. NHS spending on homeopathy is absolutely tiny. Last year, the NHS spent well over 25 times more on management consultants than it did on the four NHS homeopathic hospitals.
Bobby, who else has been sort of writing on these blogs?
Well, here's a comment from somebody called Still Fed Up, who says, at least explain the principle of dilution, at least why the most diluted and efficacious solutions would have no molecules of active compound in it at all. If you can't do this, no scientist is ever going to believe you.
This is the idea, of course, that homeopathic medicines are diluted, and the more diluted they get, the better they are at doing whatever they claim to do.
But Commander Keane was even more scathing, really. Peter Fisher, your views on homeopathy are fraudulent, dangerous and deceitful. You're deluded to think that there is anything other than a placebo effect.
And Bobby, final one from you?
So this is from Larry Tornell, who has debilitating arthritis pain and said, "I'm so despairing of the neglect I've suffered at the hands of the medical profession over the past 20 years. I ask all you sceptics out there, why the hell not? After all, if I can't be helped by conventional medicine, I find something that works for me and probably costs a damn sight less than an operation, why not?"
Okay, well, those are just a flavour of the hundreds of comments that came on after Peter Fisher's letter and the open letter from Gustav Born. And you can see all of those at commentisfree.guardian.co.uk. Well, we're almost done for another week. Trust me, you'll get over it. Let's hear what you've been telling us over the past 7 days. Kerry Perkins has written in to say...
Okay, I may have had to listen to it twice, but I reckon I've now got a half-decent grasp on this dark matter business. Thanks, Pod Squad. An issue of gravity indeed, Johnny B. No, I can't sing it. And we need Johnny B here.
Well, there's some lines
It is a dark, dark matter there.
There's some lines from the song there that James refuses to sing for some reason.
Go on, you sing them.
The man's a genius. We know that Johnny B's a genius. Go back and listen to that song again, people. It's superb. And again, Johnny Berliner, we salute you. We've had another message. This one's from Thomas Joel Webb in Edinburgh.
"Hey there, dudes and dudesses. Sorry to hear about the Cutty Sark. I used to live in Lewisham, so it was a bit of a blow to me, as much as it must have been to all the other wannabe pirates out there. Arr. Anyhow, I've just been listening to your science podcast, in which you will recall you have a section on dark matter. Excellent guitar playing, I may add. It just so happens that my uncle is chief scientist at Kitts Peak Space Observatory in Tucson, Arizona. He's been there all his life, so I guess if anyone in the world knows what dark matter is, he does. At least he could bring you all one step closer to the truth. P.S. Please don't write me off as a wacko. It's all true."
A wacko? Listening to this show? Never. Thomas, hold tight. We may be in touch about your uncle. Anyway, Ben, some more music, please. Subtlety there. We're going to wrap up this show by talking about the Hay Festival. See, that's why we picked that track by Cat Power, which this year is being sponsored by none other than The Guardian. Bill Clinton called it the Woodstock of the mind. And if you like books and an intelligent debate about literature and the odd bit of science, you really can't do much better. Our very own Nell Bowes is organising our coverage of the event, and we'll hear more from her in just a moment. But first, we need to let you in on a bit of a secret here, dear listeners. We've recorded this show on a Friday, so by the time you listen to this, James will be in the middle of the hardest conversation of his life, as he debates with Richard Dawkins, Steve Jones and Martin Rees, all of whom, incidentally, will be interviewing for Science Weekly. So, James, it sounds pretty daunting. What's your plan of action for this debate?
Well, you're right. It's a fabulous panel, really. And the title of the debate, the Guardian Science debate, is Have We Abandoned the Enlightenment? And a topic dear to our heart on the podcast. This issue with people seeming to want to embrace all forms of pseudoscience, homeopathy, alternative medicines, crystal healing, all the kind of things that Ben Goldacre has a go at week in, week out. Why are those things so popular these days? Why do people seem to want to grasp for those easy answers? Whose fault is it? Is it because scientists are just not communicating what they're doing properly? Or is it that, you know, people want to kind of rail against authority figures? I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see what comes out of that debate and what kind of questions we get from the floor.
I can't imagine that any of those three that you've got speaking there are going to pull their punches on this issue. All three of them have vocally made their points about things like intelligent design,
absolutely,
and crystal healing, Dawkins and Jones especially. But are you going to try and get them to give the audience a sort of a guide to how to deal with pseudoscience?
Yeah, you're right. We need to steer it in the direction of what do scientists do about this, and are things getting better or worse? You know, are they under the impression that they're losing the battle that they're fighting so hard, or do they see signs of hope? I'm sure there'll be people in the audience who are kind of staunch rationalists, you know, the kind of Guardian reader who's pretty sceptical about religion and that kind of thing. I think there'll be people there who want some hope and want some evangelism in how to go forward, how to kind of fight the good fight. And as you say, you know, what do we need to do?
Well, I'm sure.
Tell us, Dawkins.
I'm sure that it's going to be very interesting. We'll hear more about that, more audio clips from that next week's show. Nell is also at the Hay Festival. Give us a bit of an insight, Nell, about what other stuff we can be looking forward to science-wise.
Well, we've got quite a lot going on for the rest of the week. Robert Winston, who I'll be interviewing about his book Child Against All Odds, which is going back to his roots as a fertility expert. And then in a slight change of scale that day, we've also got John Gribbin on the eventual fate of the solar system.
Apparently he's going to be talking about, you know, putting climate change into context by saying that in about 4 billion years we're all going to be engulfed by a supernova. I'm not sure what kind of message that's going to give out to people.
Particularly given the ecological slant of hay this year.
Well, I was going to say, talking of ecological things, Tony Juniper is going to be talking on Friday morning about his handy guide to saving the planet. Sounds like an interesting thing to go and see.
And on Saturday, I believe we've got Raj Prasad on attraction or something like that. I'm not sure how.
You look sceptical. I can see it in your face.
Did I mention pseudoscience? I don't know. No, of course not.
could be a subject for James's thing on Monday.
And not so much science, but maybe for the nature lovers, there's also Attenborough, David Attenborough on that one Saturday as well.
Always worth watching. Well, all of those things are, as we've previewed, we're going to hopefully have audio from as many of those as possible over the coming weeks. So look out for all of that.
Hello, I'm Safraz Manzoor. Join me for The Guardian's daily podcast from the Hay Festival. I'll be speaking to some of the biggest names in books, everyone from Ian Rankin to Beryl Bainbridge. We'll also have daily features from around Hay, from busking to poetry, and giving you the chance to put your questions to your favourite author. So join me every day from Saturday, May the 26th to Monday, June the 4th for The Guardian's Haycast.
Ah, nice music, Hay people. That's your lot, folks. If you want to get in touch about anything we've discussed, email science@guardian.co.uk, head to the blog, or if you're feeling all Web 2.0, make your way over to myspace.com/guardianscience, or even head to Facebook and look for the I Listen to the Guardian Science Podcast Network. If you like what you've heard this week, why not investigate our back catalogue? You'll find a full archive of every programme we've ever done at guardian.co.uk/science/podcast. Remember to listen to the Science Extra this week with John Barrowman at CERN, and next week an exclusive interview with Dan Dennett. Anyway, my thanks to James and Bobby, by the way, who've been standing up for this entire programme to give it, you know, a bit of Friday energy. And Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, who hasn't been standing up, and I've been Alec Jarre, who has been standing up. Adios.
Does it sound any different?
Guardian Unlimited.